Hello, and welcome to Social Design Insights, the show that brings you the leading voices of the social design movement from the fields of architecture, engineering, planning, art, and whomever else we can find that's out there trying to make the world a better place. I'm your host, Eric Kessel. We've got an amazing show for you today. Today we're joined by Starhawk, an American writer, teacher, and activist. Disclaimer, in our short show, we're only able to touch on a fraction of all that Starhawk does and has done. She is the author or co-author of 13 books, including The Spiral Dance, A Rebirth of the Ancient Religion of the Great Goddess, a book widely credited with kicking off the entire goddess movement. She's also the author of the Ecotopian novel The Fifth Sacred Thing and its sequel, City of Refuge. Both books are eerily prescient fiction, the former being written in the early 90s and yet adroitly describing some of the ideological conflicts over the earth with which we now wrestle. Her most recent nonfiction book is The Empowerment Manual, a guide for collaborative groups on group dynamics, power, conflict, and communications. I know y'all are going to want to get a hold of that, so we will link to it on the website. We're talking about the climate emergency today, and in so doing, I think we've always wanted to emphasize that it's not rocket science. The means to live peacefully in cooperation with the Earth has always existed, and indeed it was perfected long ago. The question is, what are we prepared to do? I asked Starhawk to the show specifically for her expertise in permaculture and notably how her work has intertwined permaculture and activism. I think we're past the point in history where the two can be separated. Having a relationship with nature means being an activist, and vice versa. As you'll hear in the interview, for Starhawk, the two naturally fold out of each other. Starhawk co-founded Earth Activist Training with Penny Livingston Stark, which teaches permaculture design grounded in spirituality and with a focus on activism. She's a celebrated theorist of feminist neo-paganism and ecofeminism, and has been active in a plethora of global social movements going back to the Vietnam War. I'm running my mouth again too much, and would much rather hear Starhawk explain her own work, and you will too, so let's get to the show. Starhawk, thank you so much for joining us. Welcome to the show.
Glad to be on.
We're here to talk about climate crisis and climate emergency. And, you know, those are terms that have gotten a lot of traction lately. I personally remain suspicious because I think we've been in crisis since the Victorian era. And people are just kind of, you know, waking up to it in fits and starts. But, you know, I wanted to talk because of all the things that you do, and it's a lot, there's this particular strand of thought that's been ringing in my head ever since we started planning this segment. And that's about connection. And maybe one of the reasons it's been so hard to get people to deal with climate change is because globally, people are so disconnected from it. You know, we're disconnected from our ecosystems and sometimes even from our own climates. Like, you know, we feel the earth getting hotter, but we can always just turn up the AC. So there's this disconnect from the natural world. For you, is that where it starts, all this kind of climate change, climate emergency? Or am I just projecting?
Well, I think that is pretty core to both why we're in the mess we're in and why it seems so hard to get out of it. We live in a culture and a society that is based on a set of values that really don't center the value of the natural world and the actual life support systems of the earth that actually sustain our lives.
So it's a crisis of value.
It's a very deep crisis of value. I believe we have to work this on many, many different levels, from the deeply spiritual and philosophical to the extremely detailed and practical. But I think it's very helpful on all those levels if we remain clear that it is ultimately a crisis of values and of worldview, and that we are struggling for and hopefully moving toward a worldview that deeply understands the interconnectedness of all things, of humans, of human life, of the animals and plants and insects and microbiology and minerals and everything else that supports our lives.
I like that a lot. And, you know, it reminds me of another thread in your work about what I will certainly inaccurately call relationship, you know, and kind of pointing out that so much of our contemporary existence is based on hierarchical relationships. You know, this has value, but that has less value. And that has, you know, enabled economies of extraction. It's enabled colonialism. It's enabled the degradation of the earth and the kind of ruining of the biosphere. What strategies do you deploy in terms of, you know, maybe poking people in the brain, you know, and saying, hey, wait a minute, you know, we don't have to think about all of our relationships as hierarchical. We can think of them as interconnected and mutually dependent.
Well, I think the dominant culture really trains us to see things as separate, isolated objects and to look at simple cause and effect relationships and to look for one magic bullet, you know, one thing that's going to save us all. And I think climate change in some ways is a great wake-up call to say, well, actually, things aren't separate. Things are interrelated. You know, the choice that I make in terms of what type of car I drive or whether I drive or whether I bicycle does have an impact on whether somebody in the Midwest loses their farm to a flood.
Hmm.
You know, and even more, the larger choices we make as a society about what type of energy structure we're going to have, what type of economic structure we're going to have, you know, have enormous impacts on what happens to people all over the world. And we can't separate those things anymore. We have to look at things as a whole. And that's a worldview that has always been held in indigenous cultures. I mean, I'm always wary about talking about, quote, indigenous culture, because there are thousands of indigenous cultures and have been probably hundreds of thousands, and they're all different and they have great diversity within them. But I think there is a common thread of any culture that where people actually live in close, immediate, day-to-day relationship with the earth and the natural world that does understand that we are related to everything. And you can hear that. The Lakota often will say, you know, Ho Metakwayasin, all my relations. The Pomo, there was a Pomo healer and doctor named Mabel McKay. The Pomo are the indigenous people from the area where I live in Northern California, in Sonoma County. She would say, if you don't use the plants, if you don't talk to them, if you don't sing to them, if you don't interact with them, they'll die. There is this sense of mutuality that we are in relationship to all of these things. And there's not like a separate realm of humans, completely separate from animals and plants and minerals and all these other things. That we are all relatives. We are all connected. And I think it's very important that we start to cultivate that kind of sensibility, because it's actually much closer to the reality of things than the idea that we are separate, we are isolated, and that we can do things without having an impact on everything else.
And then there was this transition, no? I mean, arising out of this philosophy, a rejection of those more dominant modes of thinking about the earth and our relationship with it. That was originally the impetus behind earth activist training, was it not? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Penny Livingston Stark and I founded Earth Activist Training in 2000. We were both very inspired by some of the activism in the global justice movement, particularly the big blockade in Seattle in 1999 that shut the meeting down.
Yeah, I remember.
We saw all these young activists fired up with enthusiasm to change the world. And we thought, do they all know what to change it into?
Hmm. Let's expand on that, because, you know, I seem to remember another lecture of yours where, you know, you were saying something to the effect of, you know, it's really hard to mobilize people around the idea that they're the problem. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we have to have a vision of the world, not just a vision of the world that we don't want. So starting at, let's say, WTO in 99, you know, how did you start shaping these trainings to assist with that, to help people create their own vision of the world?
Well, we decided to offer some trainings in permaculture that would incorporate a grounding in spirit, which is important to both of us, because we both feel that if you don't somehow generate your own spiritual practice, if you don't have some personal source of renewal in your life, it's hard to maintain activism and hope and optimism and energy in these challenging times that we live in. And that would also focus on some training and organizing and activism. And we wanted to both bring permaculture to the activists, but also bring activism to the permaculture world and to people that we could see had great solutions, but often weren't thinking about the power structures that were in the way of implementing those solutions.
Can we talk more about those power structures?
Yes. You know, the structures of capitalism, this growing inequality, social and economic inequality, and the immense amount of brutality and violence that's being used to maintain it. I think we really do have to contend with that, because if that weren't in the way, then the solutions to climate change are no-brainer.
Right. Yeah.
You know, we need to get off oil and we need to change to renewables. Well, we actually have the technology to do that. We could probably have incredibly more effective technology if we put half the money and resources into it we've done into things like oil and gas and nuclear. But even without that, we have great technological solutions. We need to stop doing dirty, nasty things and start doing things that are actually nice, things like rebuilding community. And particularly, we need to stop growing our food in ways that poison it and that destroy the living communities of the earth. And instead, we need to shift to regenerative modes of food growing and agriculture and land management. And that's where Earth Activist Training has been going, is teaching people and training people in those things.
So just acknowledging that a lot of our audience may be far from the land, let's call it, what does that look like in terms of, you know, if the sort of imagined practice of growing food is large monocropped fields covered in pesticides, what's the alternative look like?
Well, regenerative land management has multiple facets. The first is we have to stop destroying living ecosystems. So, you know, we have so few, such little amount of pristine ecosystems left on this earth. If there's a place where we have old growth forests or probably even less pristine natural prairie or something that hasn't already been altered by human impact, or at least, I mean, everything's been altered by human impact, but massively altered, we need to protect it. That's number one. Then we need to start working with nature. We need to understand that all of food grows because of living soil. This idea that we can grow food by pouring in chemical fertilizers has resulted sometimes in short-term gains, but long-term, it results in the death of the soil and the tilling of the soil and the destruction of the biology that's in it, which holds the soil structure and holds the soil integrity, also allows that soil to erode, and it exposes what was living carbon, humus, stuff that makes the soil fertile, the living colonies of bacteria and fungi and all those things get exposed to the air, and the carbon that was held in the soil oxidizes, which means it mixes with oxygen and becomes carbon dioxide. We have an overabundance of carbon dioxide from burning fossil fuels, from burning things that were living hundreds of millions of years ago, got compressed in huge geological forces and changes and turned into oil and gas. But we also have excess carbon dioxide from agriculture, from exposing soil to the air and oxidizing it. So one of the key principles in regenerative land management is shifting to no-till, low-till systems, keeping the soil covered and growing food in ways that don't involve continually plowing and tilling and turning it over and don't involve pouring chemicals onto it in the form of fertilizers, pesticides. Basically, what it means is restoring healthy ecosystem, seeing our farms and our ranches as living ecosystems rather than as mechanical platforms for chemicals. And when we do that, it gives us multiple benefits. First of all, it restores the health of the soil and the microbiology that maintains that health and that unlocks the minerals and the fertility of the soil. That improves the soil structure. It holds it together better. It keeps it from eroding. It improves the soil's water holding capacity. So when rain falls, instead of just flooding, the soil can actually absorb it and hold on to it and release it more slowly, which helps both to mitigate flooding and also to mitigate droughts, which is really important because those are some of the key issues around climate change.
You're listening to Social Design Insights with Eric Kessel. We hope you've been enjoying these thoughts from Starhawk on the frameworks of ecological injustice, but we're going to take a quick break. While we're breaking, check us out on social media, where you can find out more about Starhawk and our work. You can find us on Instagram and Facebook at Social Design Insights, and on Twitter at Social Design IN. When we get back, we're going to be talking more about self-managing systems and make a case for the value of human intelligence over pesticide. Sometimes I wonder. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back with more Social Design Insights after the break. Welcome back to Social Design Insights. We've been speaking with American activist and permaculturist Starhawk about regeneration. And coming up, we're going to talk more about new farming techniques that are actually ancient and more ways in which we can learn from nature. Let's rejoin the conversation. I was wondering whether we could transition a little bit into cities, because I think that's where a lot of our audience works and plies their trade, and the human species is becoming an urbanized one. Mm-hmm. And I'm concerned that there are cynics out there that think of permaculture as something that happens out there. You know, it happens in the edge or in the rural environments or something like that. And, you know, we've had guests on periodically that explain that that's not the case, that, you know, you can live in a city and have a relationship with the natural world that's rich and rewarding. And it takes time and energy and strategies. What do you do when you're working in urban environments and with urban dwellers to emphasize the value of these things?
Well, I think cities are tremendously important and tremendous centers of human ingenuity and creativity. And there's definitely a whole field of urban permaculture that looks at how we live in our cities and how we design for the urban environment. You know, in cities, first of all, you know, a city is an ecosystem. The economic system is part of that ecosystem. And we can design into our cities ways, again, to handle the water flows, handle the energy flows. There's a tremendous amount of food we can produce in and around our cities, in our backyards, in our front yards, and ways to grow food that are beautiful as well as productive. We can also look at ways to grow food close to our cities and protect our farmlands that are close by, so that we don't have to grow it all necessarily, you know, in the middle of the street, but we also don't have to transport our food. You know, the average piece of food travels something like 1,500 miles before it gets to your plate. Yeah.
Wow.
Huh. And that's a tremendous energy cost.
Yeah.
There's a huge movement now around things like farmers markets and CSAs, community supported agriculture, where people can pay a farmer to provide them with a box of food each week, where people can go to farmers markets and buy directly from local farmers. That helps support local and place-based agriculture. So a lot of the decisions that we make in cities are really important as far as what we support in the growing lands around us. There's also a lot of infrastructure. Cities are great in that in many ways your carbon footprint might be much less in the city than it is out in the country. Toby Hemingway, who is a wonderful permaculture designer, teacher, writer, who unfortunately passed a couple of years ago, but I remember meeting him in Portland, where he had moved into the city from living way out in the country. And one of the things he said was, well, when I was in the country, I had to drive everywhere. You know, I had to get in the car to go to any grocery store, any meeting. In the city, I can use public transportation. I have tremendous resource flows available to me that are all right here. So you can be in the city. I do have a house in the city, shared house that we've had for 30 years or more in San Francisco, where we have solar panels. We have a gray water system. You know, we have a garden that's a little too shady to grow a lot of food, but can definitely grow herbs and grow flowers and grow beauty and grow climate. Because, again, cities tend to become heat islands, which generate immense amounts of heat, you know, which contributes to global warming. But if we create our houses as little oases of green planting, there's many things we can do within the cities to mitigate that environment. In San Francisco, you know, they've begun doing curb cuts and ways to keep storm runoff instead of flowing out and going into the sewers and overloading the sewers when there's storms, to collect it in rain gardens with curb cuts off the street and infiltrate and replenish the aquifers and the water table of the city so that the people who are growing plants then need less irrigation. And, you know, cities are also where policy is generated. So the more that people in the cities understand the concepts around regenerative systems, the more we can be advocates for the policies that can actually help turn this environmental disaster around into a massive opportunity for change and growth.
That is so cool, Starhawk. And I hope you have me over sometime. I've heard a lot about this house. Starhawk, it seems like these ideas, of course, they're manifest in all your work and all over the world, but just to root for the home team, the hometown here, you've been very active in Bayview Hunters Point. Can you tell us a little bit about that project?
Bayview Hunters Point is the neighborhood in San Francisco that traditionally has been a Black neighborhood. A lot of people moved up there to work in the shipyards because there was a naval shipyard there in World War II. But then in the late 70s, the shipyard was closed. And so it's been an area that's been very depressed. Earth Activist Training, again, our organization that teaches permaculture design and regenerative land management with a grounding in spirit and a focus on organizing and activism. We have always had an eye on how do we actually bring these tools to the communities that are most impacted by environmental challenges. Bayview Hunters Point, the old shipyard, has been for many years a massive Superfund site, and there's tremendous environmental challenges. There was a power plant there, a polluting, very polluting power plant that was causing high rates of asthma. There were high rates of poverty. You know, a lot of times in movements, we're looking around going like, whoa, this is a great movement, but people in it are mostly white people. Where are the indigenous people? Where are the people of color? I've always felt like it's vitally important to ask those questions, but not necessarily to then like run out in the street and try to grab people and bring them in. Where they are might be dealing with issues that are of paramount importance to them. So are there ways we can show up and support what they're doing? So Earth Activist Training started looking probably 15 years ago, and we were connected to a group in Hunters Point called Hunters Point Family that had taken on a couple of abandoned community gardens and were developing programs with young people to pay them a little bit of money to work in the garden, grow food. The idea is that would help bring some healthy food into an area that's kind of a food desert where there aren't a lot of grocery stores or produce available, and give them some skills. And we started by helping support what they were doing, volunteering, doing some trainings for them, and eventually training some people who then took over the programs and created some amazing programs that went beyond just the garden. But also, you know, one of the things we realized is it's not enough to grow food if people aren't in the habit of eating it, don't know how to cook it or what to do with it. So it's about growing the food, but also cooking the food and recovering the kinds of food cultures that may have been lost a lot in present day urban living, where it's easier to go to McDonald's than it is to go home and actually cook a meal for a family, especially if you're holding down two or three jobs to try to make a living, or you're a single mom that you don't have much time to do much of anything. It's a big shift to start thinking about, how do we actually cook? How do we actually provide for our family health? It's a big shift to take kids who honestly don't have a lot of innate interest in eating vegetables and get them excited about it. Along with that, what we have also been doing for the last 7 or 8 years in Earth Activist Training is offering diversity scholarships to our courses, and trying to offer enough so that we're not just bringing in a couple of one or two people of color, but we're bringing in enough people that can actually shift the overarching culture of each course and each training. And that has been tremendously exciting and challenging, but I think it has made an impact on the permaculture movement as a whole, especially out here on the West Coast. And it's just brought such tremendous people kind of into our sphere. So, you know, Pandora Thomas, who's an amazing environmental designer and teacher, teaches a lot with our program. We've been working to train and mentor a number of leaders from communities of color and indigenous communities. So again, that we can make sure that these skills and tools are really available to the communities that are on the front lines of the impacts of climate change.
I think that's wonderful, and a wonderful place to close. I mean, we started off talking about relationships and the hierarchy of relationships, as well as our crisis of values. And now we brought a full circle to talking about the front lines, which is where I know our audience is. Starhawk, thank you so much for joining us and lending us your wisdom on this critical issue. For our listeners, check out the website. We'll link to all of Starhawk's work, and it's definitely worth going through. Starhawk has been a leader and a pioneer in several different fields, and we barely scratched the surface on this interview. So, Starhawk, thank you again for joining us. You've been listening to Social Design Insights with Eric Kessel. I'd like to thank Starhawk, my guest for the week, for all of her insights into permaculture and ways to live in more concert with the Earth. As we think about how to design for the climate emergency, we should always remember that we have a pretty significant precedent study. It's called the Whole History of the Earth. It's a system that actually runs pretty well when it's not been run amok. And that's a crisis of value, as Starhawk pointed out. To put zero value on a forest and near infinite value on some recent startup never really made any sense. It makes even less sense now. We need to shift from thinking about the profit of a forest to thinking about the cost of not having forests. To learn more about Starhawk and her work, please visit our website at currystonefoundation.org. If you have any feedback on the show, ideas for guests, or just want to chat, you can write to me at eric@socialdesigninsights.com. Social Design Insights is produced by Brooke Zeichner, and at the break, we are listening to Woman of the Woods by Rosie Hodgson from her album Rise Aurora. Social Design Insights is an initiative of the Curry Stone Foundation. For all the latest news on social impact design, check us out on social media. We're on Instagram and Facebook at Social Design Insights, and on Twitter at Social Design IN.